said Touchstone, who only heard across the wall.
Good!
Chapter 25.
Big pardon, sir, said the soldier, saluting at the doorway to the officer's bathroom. Duty officer's compliments, and can you come straight away?
Colonel Horries sighed, put down his razor, and used the flannel to wipe off the remains of the shaving soap. He had been interrupted shaving that morning, and had tried several times during the day to finish the job. Perhaps it was a sign he should grow a moustache.
"What's happening?" he asked resignedly.
Whatever was happening, it was unlikely to be good.
"An aircraft, sir," replied the private stolidly. "From Army HQ? Dropping a message cylinder?" "I don't know, sir. It's on the other side of the wall."
"What?"
exclaimed Horries, dropping all his shaving gear, picking up his helmet and sword, and attempting to rush out all at the same time.
"Impossible!"
But when he eventually sorted himself out and got down to the forward observation post, an octagonal strong point that thrust out through the perimeter to within 50 yards of the wall, it quite clearly was possible. The light was fading as the afternoon waned. It was probably close to setting on the other side, but the visibility was good enough to make out the distant airborne shape that was descending in a series of long, gradual loops on the other side of the wall, in the Old Kingdom. The duty officer was watching through big artillery spotters' binoculars, his elbows perched on the sandbagged parapet of the position. Horries paused for a moment to think of the fellow's name. He was new to the perimeter garrison, then tapped him on the shoulder.
"Jorbert, mind if I have a look?"
The young officer lowered the binoculars reluctantly and handed them across like a boy deprived of a half-eaten lollipop.
"It's definitely an aircraft, sir," he said, brightening up as he spoke. "Totally silent, like a glider. But it's clearly powered somehow. Very manoeuvrable, and beautifully painted, too. There's two people in it, sir."
Horries didn't answer, but took up the binoculars in the same elbow-propping stance. For a moment he couldn't see the aircraft, and he hastily panned left and right, then zigzagged up and down, and there it was, lower than he expected, almost in a landing approach.
"Sound stand to!" he ordered harshly, as the realization struck him that the craft would land very close to the crossing point, perhaps only 100 yards from the gate.
He heard his command being repeated by Jorbert to a sergeant, and then bellowed out, to be taken up by sentries, duty NCOs, and eventually to hand-cranked klaxons and the old bell that hung in the front of the officer's mess. It was hard to see exactly who or what was in the craft, till he twiddled with the focus, and Sabriel's face leapt towards him, magnified up to a recognizable form, even at the current distance. Sabriel, the daughter of Abhorsen, accompanied by an unknown man, or something wearing the shape of a man. For a moment, Horries considered ordering the men to stand down, but he could already hear hobnailed boots clattering on the duckboards, sergeants and corporals shouting, and it might not really be Sabriel. The sun was weakening, and the coming night would be the first of the full moon.
"Jorbert!"
he snapped, handing the binoculars back to the surprised and unready subaltern.
"Go and give the regimental sergeant-major my compliments, and ask him to personally organize a section of the scouts. We'll go out and take a closer look at that aircraft." "Oh, thank you, sir,"
gushed Lieutenant Jorbert, obviously taking the "we" to include himself. His enthusiasm surprised Horries, at least for a moment.
"Tell me, Mr. Jorbert," he asked, "have you by any chance sought a transfer to the Flying Corps?" "Well, yes, sir," replied Jorbert. 8 times. "Just remember," Horries said, interrupting him, "that whatever is out there may be a flying creature, not a flying machine, and its pilots may be half-rotted things that should be properly dead, or free magic beings that have never really lived at all, not fellow aviators, knights of the sky, or anything like that."
Jorbert nodded, unmilitarily, saluted, and turned on his heel.
"And don't forget your sword next time you're on duty, officer," Horace called after him. "Hasn't anyone told you your revolver might not work?"
Jawbert nodded again, flushed, almost saluted, then scuttled off down the communication trench. One of the soldiers in the forward observation post, a corporal, with a full sleeve of chevrons denoting 20 years' service, and a charter mark on his forehead to show his perimeter pedigree, shook his head at the departing back of the young officer.
"Why are you shaking your head, Corporal Anshire?"
snapped Horace, irked by his many interrupted shaves and this new and potentially dangerous appearance of an aircraft.
"Water on the brain," replied the corporal cheerfully,
and rather ambiguously. Horace opened his mouth to issue a sharp reprimand, then closed it as the corners of his mouth involuntarily inched up into a smile. Before he could actually laugh, he left the post, heading back to the trench junction, where his section and the RSM would meet him to go beyond the wall. Within 5 paces, he'd lost his smile. The paper wing slid to a perfect landing in a flurry of snow. Sabriel and Touchstone sat in it, shivering under oilskin and boat cloak, respectively, then slowly levered themselves out to stand knee-deep in the tightly packed snow. Touchstone smiled at Sabriel, his nose bright red and eyebrows frosted.
"We made it."
"So far," replied Sabriel, warily looking around. She could see the long grey bulk of the wall, with the deep honey-coloured sun of autumn on the Anselstieren side. Here the snow lay banked against the grey stone, and it was overcast, with the sun almost gone, dark enough for the dead to be wandering around. Touchstone's smile faded as he caught her mood, and he took his swords from the paper wing, giving the left sword to Sabriel. She sheathed it, but it was a bad fit, another reminder of loss. "I'd better get the books, too," she said, bending in to retrieve them from the cockpit. The two charter magic books were fine, untouched by snow, but the Book of the Dead seemed wet. When Sabriel pulled it out, she found it wasn't snow wet. Beads of dark, thick blood were welling up out of its cover. Silently, Sabriel wiped it on the hard crust of the snow, leaving a livid mark. Then she tucked the books away in the pockets of her coat.
Why was the book like that?
Asked Touchstone, trying, and almost succeeding, to sound curious rather than afraid.
I think it's reacting to the presence of many deaths, Sabriel replied. There is great potential here for the dead to rise. This is a very weak point.
Touchstone interrupted her, pointing towards the wall. Shapes, dark against the snow, were moving in an extended line towards them at a deliberate, steady pace. They carried bows and spears, and Sabriel at least recognized the rifles slung across their backs.
"It's all right," Sabriel said, though a faint stab of nervousness touched her stomach. "They're soldiers from the Anselstieren side. Still, I might send the paper wing on its way." Quickly, she checked that they'd taken everything from the cockpit, then laid her hand on the nose of the paper wing, just above its twinkling eye. It seemed to look up at her as she spoke. "Go now, friend. I don't want to risk you being dragged into Anselstier and taken apart. Fly where you will, to the Clare's Glacier, or, if you care to Abhorsen's house, where the water falls." She stepped back and formed the charter marks that would imbue the paper wing with choice and the winds to lift it there. The marks went into her whistle, and the paper wing moved with the rising pitch, accelerating along till it leapt into the sky at the peak of the highest note.
"I say," exclaimed a voice, "how did you do that?"
Sabriel turned to see a young, out-of-breath Anselstieren officer, the single gold pip of a second lieutenant, looking lonely on his shoulder straps. He was easily 50 yards in front of the rest of the line, but he didn't seem frightened. He was clutching a sword and a revolver, though, and he raised both of them as Sabriel stepped forward.
halt! You are my prisoners!
Actually, we're travellers, replied Sabriel, though she did stand still. Is that Colonel Horees I can see behind you?
Jorbert turned half around to have a look, realized his mistake, and turned back just in time to see Sabriel and Touchstone smiling, then chuckling, then out and out laughing, clutching at each other's arms.
What's so funny?
Demanded Lieutenant Jorbert, as the two of them laughed and laughed till the tears ran down their cheeks.
Nothing, said Horees, gesturing to his men to encircle Sabriel and Touchstone,
while he went up and carefully placed two fingers on their foreheads, testing the charter they bore within. Satisfied, he lightly shook them till they stopped their shuddering, gasping laughter. Then, to the surprise of some of his men, he put an arm around each of them and led them back to the crossing point, towards Anselstier and Sunshine. Jorbert, left to cover the withdrawal, indignantly asked the heir,
"What was so funny?"
"You heard the colonel,"
replied Regimental Sergeant Major Talklish.
"Nothing. That was an hysterical reaction, that was. They've been through a lot, those two. Mark my words."
Then, in the way that only RSMs have with junior officers, he paused, crushing Jorbert completely with a judicious and long-delayed,
"Sir?"
The warmth wrapped Sabriel like a soft blanket as they stepped out of the shadow of the wall into the relative heat of an Anselstieran autumn. She felt Touchstone falter at her side and stumble, his face staring blindly upwards to the sun.
"You both look done in,"
said Horees, speaking in the kindly, slow tone he used on shell-shocked soldiers.
"How about something to eat? Or would you rather get some sleep first?"
"Something to eat, certainly," Sabriel replied, trying to give him a grateful smile. "But not sleep. There's no time for that. Tell me, when was the full moon? 2 days ago?"
Horees looked at her, thinking that she no longer reminded him of his own daughter. She had become Ab Horson, a person beyond his ken, in such a short time.
"It's tonight," he said.
"But I've been in the Old Kingdom at least 16 days.
"Time is strange between the kingdoms," Horees said. "We've had patrols swear they were out for 2 weeks, coming back in after 8 days.
A headache for the paymaster."
"That voice coming from the box on the pole,"
Touchstone interrupted, as they left the zigzag path through the wire defences and climbed down into a narrow communication trench.
"There is no charter magic in the box, or the voice..."
"Ah," replied Horees, looking ahead to where a loudspeaker was announcing stand-down.
"I'm surprised it's working. Electricity runs that, Mr. Touchstone. Science, not magic."
"It won't be working tonight," Sabriel said quietly.
"No technology will be." "Yes, it is rather loud," Horees said, in a strong voice. More softly, he added, "Please don't say anything more till we get to my dugout. The men have already picked something up about tonight and the full moon."
"Of course," replied Sabriel wearily. "I'm sorry."
They walked the rest of the way in silence, slogging along the zigzagging communication trench, passing soldiers in the fighting trenches, ready at their stand-to positions. The soldiers' conversations stopped as they passed, but resumed as soon as they turned the next zig or zag and were out of sight. At last, they descended a series of steps into Colonel Horees's dugout. Two sergeants stood guard outside, this time charter mages from the crossing point scouts, not the regular garrison infantry. Another soldier doubled off to the cookhouse to fetch some food. Horees busied himself with a small spirit burner and made tea. Sabriel drank it without feeling much relief. Anselstier and the universal comforter of its society, tea, no longer seemed as solid and dependable as she had once thought.
"Now," said Horees, "tell me why you don't have time to sleep."
"My father died yesterday," Sabriel said, stony-faced. "The wind flutes will fail tonight, at moonrise. The dead here will rise with the moon.
I'm sorry to hear about your father. Very sorry,
Hori said. He hesitated, then added, But as you are here now, can't you bind the dead anew? If that were all, yes, I could, Sabriel continued. But there is worse to come. Have you ever heard the name Kerrigor, Colonel?
Horis put his tea down.
Your father spoke of him once. One of the greater dead, I think, imprisoned beyond the seventh gate.
More than greater. Possibly the great, Sabriel said bleakly. As far as I know, he is the only dead spirit to also be a free magic adept.
And a renegade member of the royal family, added Touchstone,
his voice still harsh and dry from the cold winds of their flight, unquenched by tea.
And he is no longer imprisoned. He walks in life.
All these things give him power, Sabriel continued. But there is a weakness there, too. Kerrigor's mastery of free magic, and much of his power in both life and death, is dependent on the continual existence of his original body. He hid it long ago, when he first chose to become a dead spirit, and he hid it in Anselstier, near the village of Wyverley, to be exact.
And now he's coming to fetch it, said Horis, with terrible prescience.
Outwardly, he looked calm, all those long years of army service forming a hard carapace, containing his feelings. Inwardly, he felt a trembling that he hoped wasn't being transmitted to the mug in his hand.
When will he come?
With the night, replied Sabriel. With an army of the dead. If he can emerge out of death close to the wall, he may come earlier.
The sun, Horis began.
Kerrigor can work the weather, bring fog or dense cloud.
So what can we do?
Asked Horis, turning his palms outwards towards Sabriel, his eyes questioning.
Abhorsen?
Sabriel felt a weight placed upon her, a burden adding to the weariness that already pressed upon her, but she forced herself to answer. Kerrigor's body is in a spelled sarcophagus under a cairn atop a little hill called Docky Point, less than 40 miles away. We need to get there quickly and destroy the body.
And that will destroy Kerrigor?
No, said Sabriel, shaking her head wistfully, but it will weaken him, so there may be a chance.
Right, said Horis. We've still got 3 or 4 hours of daylight, but we'll need to move quickly. I take it that Kerrigor and his, forces will have to cross the wall here. They can't just pop out at Docky Point.
No, agreed Sabriel. They'll have to emerge in life in the Old Kingdom and physically cross the wall. It would probably be best not to try and stop him.
I'm afraid we can't do that, replied Horis. That's what the perimeter garrison is here for.
A lot of your soldiers will die to no purpose, then, said Touchstone.
Simply because they'll be in the way. Anything and anybody that gets in Kerrigor's way will be destroyed. So you want us to just let this thing, and a
hide, Horis.
That's what the perimeter garrison is here for.
A lot of your soldiers will die to no purpose, then, said Touchstone.
Simply because they'll be in the way. Anything and anybody that gets in Kerrigor's way will be destroyed. So you want us to just let this thing and a horde of dead descend on Anselstier?
Not exactly, replied Sabriel. I would like to fight him at a time and a place more of our choosing. If you lend me all the soldiers here who have the charter mark and a little charter magic, we may have enough time to destroy Kerrigor's body. Also, we will be almost 35 miles from the wall. Kerrigor's power may only be slightly lessened, but many of his minions will be weaker, perhaps so weak that destroying or damaging their physical forms will be sufficient to send them back into death.
And the rest of the garrison? We'll just stand aside and let Kerrigor and his army through the perimeter?
You probably won't have a choice.
I see, muttered Horis.
He got up and paced backwards and forwards 6 steps, all the dugout would allow. Fortunately, or unfortunately perhaps, I am currently acting as the general officer commanding the whole perimeter. General Ashenbur has returned south due to, ill health. A temporary situation only. Army HQ is loath to give any sort of higher command to those of us who wear the charter mark, so the decision is mine. He stopped pacing and stared back at Sabriel and Touchstone, but his eyes seemed to see something well beyond them and the rusty corrugated iron that walled the dugout. Finally he spoke. Very well. I will give you 12 charter mages, half of the full complement of the scouts. But I will also add some more mundane force, a detachment, to escort you to, what was it? Docky Point. But I can't promise we won't fight on the perimeter. We need you too, Colonel, Sabriel said, in the silence that followed his decision. You're the strongest charter mage the garrison has.
Impossible,
Horiz exclaimed emphatically.
I'm in command of the perimeter. My responsibilities lie here.
You'll never be able to explain tonight, anyway, Sabriel said. Not to any general down south, or to anyone who hasn't crossed the wall.
I'll think about it while you have something to eat,
Horiz declared, the rattle of a tray and plates tactfully announcing the arrival of a mess orderly on the steps.
Come in.
The orderly entered, steam rising around the edges of the silver dishes. As he put the tray down, Horiz strode out past him, bellowing,
Messenger! Messenger! I want the adjutant, Major Tyndall, and the CSM from A Company, Lieutenant Eyre from the Scouts, the RSM and the Quartermaster, in the operations room in 10 minutes. Oh, call in the transport officer too, and warn the signal staff to stand by for coding.
Chapter 26. Everything moved rapidly after the tea was drunk, almost too rapidly for the exhausted Sabriel and Touchstone. Judging from the noises outside, soldiers were rushing about in all directions while they ate their belated lunch. Then, before they could even begin to digest, Horiz was back, telling them to get moving. It was somewhat like being a bit player in the school play, Sabriel thought, as she stumbled out of the communication trench and onto the parade ground. There was an awful lot happening around her, but she didn't really feel part of it. She felt Touchstone lightly brush her arm and smiled at him reassuringly. It had to be even worse for him. Within minutes, they were hustled across the parade ground towards a waiting line of trucks, an open staff car, and two strange steel-plated contraptions, lozenge-shaped, with gun turrets on either side and caterpillar tracks.
Tanks,
Sabriel realized. A relatively recent invention. Like the trucks, they were roaring, engines belching blue-gray smoke. No problem now, Sabriel thought, but the engines would stop when the wind blew in from the Old Kingdom, or when Kerrigor came. Horiz led them to the staff car, opened the back door, and gestured for them to get in. "Are you coming with us?" Sabriel asked, hesitantly, as she settled back in the heavily padded leather seats, fighting a wave of tiredness that threatened immediate sleep.
"Yes," replied Horiz, slowly.
He seemed surprised at his own answer, and suddenly far away.
"Yes, I am."
"You have the sight," said Touchstone, looking up from where he was adjusting his scabbard before sitting down. "What did you see?"
"The usual thing," replied Horiz.
He got in the front seat and nodded to the driver, a thin-faced veteran of the Scouts, whose charter mark was almost invisible on his weather-beaten forehead. "What do you mean?" asked Sabriel. But her question was lost as the driver pressed the starter switch and the car coughed and spluttered into life, a tenor accompaniment to the bass cacophony of the trucks and tanks. Touchstone jumped at the sudden noise and vibration, then smiled sheepishly at Sabriel, who'd lightly rested her fingers on his arm as if calming a child. "What did he mean, the usual thing?" asked Sabriel. Touchstone looked at her, sadness and exhaustion vying for first place in his gaze. He took her hand in his own and traced a line across her palm, a definite, ending sort of line. "Oh," muttered Sabriel. She sniffed and looked at the back of Hori's head, eyes blurring, seeing only the line of his cropped silver hair extending just past his helmet rim. "He has a daughter the same age as me, back at somewhere south," she whispered, shivering, clutching Touchstone's hand till his fingers were as white as her own. "Why, oh why, does everything, everyone..." The car started forward with a lurch, preceded by two motorcycle outriders and followed by each of the 9 trucks in turn, carefully spaced out every 100 yards. The tanks, with tracks screeching and clanking, took a side road up to the railway siding, where they would be loaded up and sent on to Wyverley Halt. It was unlikely they would arrive before nightfall. The road convoy would be at Docky Point before 6 in the afternoon. Sabriel was silent for the first 10 miles, her head bowed, hand still clutching tightly on Touchstone's. He sat silently too, but watching, looking out as they left the military zone, looking at the prosperous farms of Anselstier, the sealed roads, the brick houses, the private cars and horse-drawn vehicles that pulled off the road in front of them, cleared aside by the 2 red-capped military policemen on motorcycles. "I'm all right now," Sabriel said quietly, as they slowed to pass through the town of Bain. Touchstone nodded, still watching, staring at the shop windows in the high street. The townspeople stared back, for it was rare to see soldiers in full perimeter battle equipment, with sword, bayonets, and shields. And Sabriel and Touchstone were clearly from the Old Kingdom.
"We have to stop by the police station and warn the superintendent," Hori's announced, as their car pulled in next to an imposing white-walled edifice with 2 large blue electric lanterns hanging out the front, and a sturdy sign proclaiming it to be the headquarters of the Bainshire Constabulary. Hori's stood up, waved the rest of the convoy on, then vaulted out and dashed up the steps, a curiously incongruous figure in mail and khaki. A constable, descending the steps, looked ready to stop him, but stopped himself instead and saluted.
"I'm all right," Sabriel repeated. "You can let go of my hand."
Touchstone smiled and flexed his hand a little in her grip. She looked a bit puzzled, then smiled too, her fingers slowly relaxing till their hands lay flat on the seat, little fingers just touching. In any other town, a crowd would certainly have formed around an army staff car with 2 such unusual passengers. But this was Bain, and Bain was close to the wall. People took one look, saw charter marks, swords and armour, and went the other way. Those with natural caution, or a touch of the sight, went home and locked their doors and shutters, not merely with steel and iron, but also with sprigs of broom and rowan. Others, even more cautious, took to the river and its sandy islets, without even pretending to be fishing. Hori's came out 5 minutes later, accompanied by a tall, serious-looking man, whose large build and hawk-like visage were made slightly ridiculous by a pair of 2 small pince-nez clinging to the end of his nose. He shook hands with the colonel, Hori's returned to the car, and they were off again, the driver crashing through the gears with considerable skill. A few minutes later, before they'd left the last buildings of the town, a bell began to ring behind them, deep and slow. Only moments later, another followed from somewhere to the left, then another from up ahead. Soon there were bells ringing all around.
"Quick work!" Hori's shouted into the back of the car. "The superintendent must have made them practice in the past."
"The bells are a warning?" asked Touchstone. This was something he was familiar with, and he began to feel more at home, even with this sound, warning of dire trouble. He felt no fear from it,
but then, after facing the reservoir for a second time, he felt that he could cope with any fear.
"Yes," replied Horrees. "Be inside by nightfall, lock all doors and windows, deny entry to strangers, shed light inside and out, prepare candles and lanterns for when the electricity fails, wear silver. If caught outdoors, find running water."
"We used to recite that in the junior classes," Sabriel said, "but I don't think too many people remember it, even the people around here."
"You'd be surprised, ma'am,"
interrupted the driver, speaking out of the corner of his mouth, eyes never leaving the road.
"The bells haven't run like this in 20 years, but plenty of folk remember. They'll tell anyone who doesn't know. Don't fret about that."
"I hope so," replied Sabriel, a momentary flash of remembrance passing through her mind. The people of Nesto, 2/3 of their number lost to the dead, the survivors huddled in fish-drying sheds on a rocky island. "I hope so."
"How long till we reach Docky Point?" asked Touchstone.
He was remembering too, but his memories were of Rogier. Soon he would look on Rogier's face again, but it would only be a husk, a tool, for what Rogier had become.
"About an hour at the most, I should think," replied Horrees. "Around 6 o'clock. We can average almost 30 miles an hour in this contraption. Quite remarkable. To me, anyway. I'm so used to the perimeter and the old kingdom. The small part we saw on patrol, anyway. I'd have liked to see more of it, gone further north."
"You will," said Sabriel, but her voice lacked conviction, even to her own ears. Touchstone didn't say anything, and Horrees didn't reply. So they drove on in silence after that, soon catching the truck convoy, overtaking each vehicle till they were in front again. But wherever they drove, the bells preceded them, every village bell tower taking up the warning. As Horrees had predicted, they arrived at Wyverley Village just before 6. The trucks stopped in a line all through the village, from Policeman's Cottage to the Wyvern Pub, the men debussing almost before the vehicles stopped, quickly forming up into ranks on the road. The signals truck parked under a telephone pole, and two men swarmed up to connect their wires. The military policemen went to each end of the village to redirect traffic. Sabriel and Touchstone got out of the car and waited.
"It's not much different from the Royal Guard," Touchstone said, watching the men hurry into their parade positions, the sergeant chatting, the officers gathering around Horrees, who was speaking on the newly connected phone. "Hurry up and wait."
"I'd have liked to see you in the Royal Guard," Sabriel said. "And the Old Kingdom, in... I mean before the stones were broken."
"In my day, you mean," said Touchstone. "I would have liked that too. It was more like here then. Here normally, I mean. Peaceful and sort of slow. Sometimes I thought life was too slow, too predictable. I'd prefer that now."
"I used to think like that at school," Sabriel answered, "dreaming about the Old Kingdom, proper charter magic, dead to bind, princes to be..."
"Rescued?"
"Married," replied Sabriel, absently. She seemed intent on watching Horrees. He looked like he was getting bad news over the telephone. Touchstone didn't speak. Everything seemed to sharpen in focus for him, centering on Sabriel, her black hair gleaming like a raven's wing in the afternoon sun. "I love her," he thought. "But if I say the wrong thing now, I may never..." Horrees handed the telephone back to a signaller and turned towards them. Touchstone watched him, suddenly conscious that he probably only had 5 seconds to be alone with Sabriel, to say something, to say anything. Perhaps the last 5 seconds they would ever have alone together. "I'm not afraid," he said to himself. "I love you," he whispered. "I hope you don't mind." Sabriel looked back at him and smiled, almost despite herself. Her sadness at her father's death was still there, and her fears for the future, but seeing Touchstone staring apprehensively at her somehow gave her hope. "I don't mind," she whispered back, leaning towards him. She frowned. I think I might love you too, Charter, help me. But now is... The telephone line to the perimeter crossing point just went out, Horrys announced grimly, shouting above the village bell even before he was close enough to talk. A fog started rolling across the wall over an hour ago. It reached the forward trenches at 4:46. After that, none of the advance companies could be reached by phone or runner. I was just speaking to the duty officer then, that young chap who was so interested in your aircraft. He said the fog was just about to reach his position. Then the line went silent.
So, said Sabriel, Kerrigor didn't wait till sundown. He's working the weather.
From the timings given by the perimeter, Horry said, this fog, and whatever's in it, is moving southwards at around 20 miles an hour. As the crow flies, it'll reach us around 7:30, dark, with the moonrise yet to come.
Let's go, then, snapped Sabriel. The bridal path to Docky Point starts from behind the pub. Shall I lead?
Best not, replied Horrys.
He turned and shouted some orders, accompanied by considerable waving and pointing. Within a few seconds, men were moving off around the pub, taking the path to Docky Point. First, the crossing point scouts, archers and charter mages all. Then the first platoon of infantry, bayonets fixed, rifles at the ready. Past the pub, they shook out into an arrowhead formation. Horrys, Sabriel, Touchstone, and their driver followed. Behind them came the other two platoons and the signallers, unreeling field telephone wire from a large and cumbersome drum. It was quiet among the cork trees, the soldiers moving as silently as they could, communicating by hand signals rather than shouts. Only their heavy tread and the occasional rattle of armour or equipment disturbing the quiet. Sunshine poured down between the trees, rich and golden, but already losing its warmth, like a butter-coloured wine that was all taste and no potency. Towards the top of the hill, only the crossing point scouts went on up. The lead platoon of infantry followed a lower contour around to the northern side. The other two platoons moved to the southwest and southeast, forming a defensive triangle around the hill. Horrys, Sabriel, Touchstone, and the driver continued on. The trees fell away about 20 yards from the top of the hill, thick weeds and thistles taking their place. Then, at the highest point, there was the cairn, a solid hut-sized square of grey-green stones. The 12 scouts were grouped loosely around it, 4 of them already levering one of the cornerstones out with a long crowbar, obviously carried up for this purpose. As Sabriel and Touchstone came up, the stone fell with a thud, revealing more blocks underneath. At the same time, every charter mage present felt a slight buzzing in their ears and a wave of dizziness.
"Did you feel that?" asked Horrys,
unnecessarily, as it was clear from everyone's expressions and the hands that had gone to ears that they all had.
"Yes," replied Sabriel.
To a lesser extent, it was the same sort of feeling the broken stones caused in the reservoir.
"It will get worse, I'm afraid, as we get closer to the sarcophagus."
"How far in is it?"
4 blocks deep, I think," said Sabriel, "or 5. I saw it from an odd perspective."
Horrys nodded, and indicated to the men to keep prying away the stones. They went to it with a will, but Sabriel noticed they kept looking at the position of the sun. All the scouts were charter mages, of various power, all knew what sundown would bring. In 15 minutes they'd made a hole 2 blocks wide and 2 deep in one end, and the sickness was growing worse. 2 of the younger scouts, men in their early 20s, had become violently sick, and were recuperating further down the hill. The others were working more slowly, their energies directed to keeping lunches down and quelling shaking limbs. Surprisingly, given their lack of sleep and generally run-down state, Sabriel and Touchstone found it relatively easy to resist the waves of nausea emanating from the cairn. It didn't compare with the cold, dark fear of the reservoir there on the hill, with the sunshine and the fresh breeze warming and cooling at the same time. When the 3rd blocks came out, Horrys called a brief rest break and they all retreated down the hill to the tree line, where the cairn's sickening aura dissipated. The signallers had a telephone there, the handset sitting on the upturned drum. Horrys took it, but turned to Sabriel before the signaller wound the charging handle.
"Are there any preparations to be made before we remove the last blocks? Magical ones, I mean."
Sabriel thought for a moment, willing her tiredness away, then shook her head.
"I don't think so. Once we have access to the sarcophagus, we may have to spell it open. I'll need everyone's help for that. Then the final rites on the body, the usual cremation spell. There will be resistance then, too. Have your men often cast charter magic in concert?"
"Unfortunately, no," replied Horrys, frowning. "Because the army doesn't officially admit the existence of charter magic. Everyone here is basically self-taught."
"Never mind," Sabriel said, trying to sound confident, aware that everyone around her was listening. "We'll manage."
"Good," replied Horrys, smiling.
That made him look very confident, thought Sabriel. She tried to smile too, but was uncertain about the result. It felt too much like a grimace of pain.
"Well, let's see where our uninvited guest has got to," Horrys continued, still smiling. "Where does this phone connect to, Sergeant?" "Bane Police," replied the signals sergeant, winding the charging handle vigorously. "And Army HQ North, sir. You'll have to ask Corporal Singh to switch you. He's on the board at the village."
"Good," replied Horrys. "Hello? Oh, Singh? Put me through to Bane. No, tell North you can't get through to me." "Yes, that's right, Corporal. Thank you. Bainshire Constabulary? It's Colonel Horrys. I want to speak to Chief Superintendent Dingley." "Yes." "Hello, Superintendent. Have you had any reports of a strange, dense fog?" "What? Already?" "No. On no account investigate. Get everyone in, shutter the windows." "Yes, the usual drill." "Yes, whatever is in... Yes. Extraordinarily dangerous. Hello? Hello?"
He put the handset down slowly and pointed back up the hill.
"The fog is already moving through the northern part of Bane. It must be going much faster. Is it possible that this Kerrigor could know what we're up to?"
"Yes," replied Sabriel and Touchstone together.
"We better get a move on then," Horrys announced, looking at his watch. "I'd say we now have less than 40 minutes.
Chapter 27. The last blocks came away slowly, pulled out by sweating, white-faced men, their hands and legs shivering, breath ragged. As soon as the way was clear, they staggered back, away from the cairn, seeking patches of sunlight to combat the dreadful chill that seemed to eat at their bones. One soldier, a dapper man with a white blonde moustache, fell down the hill and lay retching till stretcher-bearers ran up to take him away. Sabriel looked at the dark hole in the cairn and saw the faint, unsettling sheen from the bronze sarcophagus within. She felt sick, too, with the hair on the back of her neck frizzing up, skin crawling. The air seemed thick with the reek of free magic, a hard, metallic taste in her mouth. "We will have to spell it open," she announced with a sinking heart. "The sarcophagus is very strongly protected. I think the best thing would be if I go in with Touchstone, taking my hand, Horrys his, and so on, to form a line reinforcement of the charter magic. Does everyone know the charter marks for the opening spell?" The soldiers nodded, or said, "Yes, ma'am." One said, "Yes, Abhorsen." Sabriel looked at him. A middle-aged corporal, with the chevrons of long service on his sleeve. He seemed one of the least affected by the free magic. "You can call me Sabriel if you want," she said, strangely unsettled by what he had called her. The corporal shook his head.
"No, miss. I knew your dad. You're just like him. The Abhorsen, now. You'll make this dead bugger, begging your pardon,
Wish he'd stayed properly bloody dead.
Thank you, Sabriel replied, uncertainly. She knew the corporal didn't have the sight. You could always tell. But his belief in her was so concrete.
He's right, said Touchstone.
He gestured for her to go in front of him, making a courtly bow.
Let's finish what we came to do, Abhorsen.
Sabriel bowed back, in a motion that had almost the feel of ritual about it. The Abhorsen bowing to the king. Then she took a deep breath, her face settling into a determined mould. Beginning to form the charter marks of opening in her mind, she took Touchstone's hand and advanced towards the open cairn, its dark, shadowy interior in stark contrast with the sunlit thistles and the tumbled stones. Behind her, Touchstone half-turned to take Horiz's calloused hand as well, the colonel's other hand already gripping Lieutenant Eyre's, Eyre gripping a sergeant's, the sergeant, the long-service corporal's, and so on down the hillside. 14 charter mages in all, if only 2 of the first rank. Sabriel felt the charter magic welling up the line, the marks glowing brighter and brighter in her mind, till she almost lost her normal vision in their brilliance. She shuffled forwards into the cairn, each step bringing that all-too-familiar nausea, the pins and needles, uncontrollable shaking, but the marks were strong in her mind, stronger than the sickness. She reached the bronze sarcophagus, slapped her hand down, and let the charter magic go. Instantly there was an explosion of light, and a terrible scream echoed all through the cairn. The bronze grew hot, and Sabriel snatched back her hand, the palm red and blistered. A second later, steam billowed out all round the sarcophagus, great gouts of scalding steam, forcing Sabriel out, the whole line going down like dominoes, tumbling out of the cairn and down the hill. Sabriel and Touchstone were thrown together about 5 yards down from the entrance to the cairn. Somehow, Sabriel's head had landed on Touchstone's stomach. His head was on a thistle, but both of them lay still for a moment, drained by the magic and the strength of the free magic defences. They looked up at the blue sky, already tinged with the red of the impending sunset. Around them there was much swearing and cursing as the soldiers picked themselves up. "It didn't open," Sabriel said, in a quiet, matter-of-fact voice. "We don't have the power, or the skill." She paused, and then added, "I wish Mogget wasn't. I wish he was here. He'd think of something."
Touchstone was silent. Then he said, "We need more charter mages. It would work if the marks were reinforced enough."
"More charter mages," Sabriel said tiredly. "We're on the wrong side of the wall."
"What about your school?" asked Touchstone. And then, "Ow!"
as Sabriel suddenly shot up, disrupting his balance. Then, "Ow!" again, as she bent down and kissed him, pushing his head further into the thistle.
"Touchstone! I should have thought. The senior magic classes. There must be 35 girls with the charter mark and the basic skills."
"Good," muttered Touchstone from the depths of the thistle.
Sabriel put out her hands and helped him up, smelling the sweat on him and the fresh, pungent odour of crushed thistles. He was halfway up when she suddenly seemed to lose her enthusiasm, and he almost fell back down again.
"The girls are there," said Sabriel, slowly, as if thinking aloud. "But have I any right to involve them in something that—"
"They're involved anyway," interrupted Touchstone. "The only reason that Ancelstier isn't like the old kingdom is the wall, and it won't last once Kerrigor breaks the remaining stones."
"They're only school children," Sabriel said sadly. "For all we always thought we were grown women."
"We need them," said Touchstone again.
"Yes," said Sabriel, turning back towards the knot of men gathered as close as they dared to the cairn. Horiz and some of the stronger charter mages peering back towards the entrance and the shimmering bronze within. "The spell failed," Sabriel said. "But Touchstone has just reminded me where we can get more charter mages."
Horiz looked at her,
urgency in his face.
Where?
Wyverley College, my old school. The fifth and sixth form magic classes, and their teacher, Magistrix Greenwood. It's less than a mile away.
I don't think we've got time to get a message there and get them over here, Horrees began, looking up at the setting sun, then at his watch, which was now going backwards.
He looked puzzled for a moment, then ignored it.
But, do you think it would be possible to move the sarcophagus?
Sabriel thought about the protective spell that she'd encountered, then answered,
Yes, most of the wards were on the cairn for concealment. There's nothing to stop us moving the sarcophagus, save the side effects of the free magic. If we can stand the sickness, we can shift it.
And Wyverley College, it's an old, solid building?
More like a castle than anything, replied Sabriel, seeing the way he was thinking.
Easier to defend than this hill. Running water?
No, that would be too much to hope for.
Right. Private Macking, run down to Major Tyndall and tell him that I want his company ready to move in 2 minutes. We're going back to the trucks, then on to Wyverley College. It's on the map, about a mile.
Southwest, Sabriel provided.
Southwest. Repeat that back.
Private Macking repeated the message in a slow drawl, then ran off, clearly keen to get away from the cairn. Horrees turned to the long service corporal and said,
Corporal Anshi, you look pretty fit. Do you think you could get a rope around that coffin?
Reckon so, sir, replied Corporal Anshi.
He detached a coil of rope from his webbing as he spoke, and gestured with his hand to the other soldiers.
Come on, you blokes, get your ropes out.
20 minutes later, the sarcophagus was being lifted by sheer legs and rope aboard a horse-drawn wagon appropriated from a local farmer. As Sabriel had expected, dragging it within 20 yards of the trucks stopped their engines, put out electric lights, and disrupted the telephone. Curiously, the horse, a placid old mare, didn't seem overly frightened by the gleaming sarcophagus, despite its bronze surface sluggishly crawling with stomach-churning perversions of charter marks. She wasn't a happy horse, but not a panicked one either.
"We'll have to drive the wagon," Sabriel said to Touchstone, as the soldiers pushed the suspended coffin aboard with long poles and collapsed the sheer legs.
"I don't think the scouts can withstand the sickness much longer."
Touchstone shuddered. Like everyone else, he was pale, eyes red-rimmed, his nose dripping and teeth chattering.
"I'm not sure I can, either."
Nevertheless, when the last rope was twitched off, and the soldiers hurried away, Touchstone climbed up to the driver's seat and picked up the reins. Sabriel climbed up next to him, suppressing the feeling that her stomach was about to rise into her mouth. She didn't look back at the sarcophagus. Touchstone said, to the horse, and flicked the reins. The mare's ears went up, and she took up the load, pacing forwards. It was not a quick pace.
"Is this as fast as..." Sabriel said anxiously. They had a mile to cover, and the sun was already bloody, a red disk balanced on the line of the horizon.
"It's a heavy load," Touchstone answered slowly,
quick breaths coming between his words as if he found it difficult to speak.
"We'll be there before the light goes."
The sarcophagus seemed to buzz and chuckle behind them. Neither of them mentioned that Kerrigor might arrive, fog-wreathed, before the night did. Sabriel found herself looking behind every few seconds, back along the road. This meant catching glimpses of the vilely shifting surface of the coffin, but she couldn't help it. The shadows were lengthening, and every time she caught a glimpse of some tree's pale bark or a whitewashed mile marker, fear twitched in her gut. Was that fog curling down the road? Wyverley College seemed much farther than a mile. The sun was only a three-quartered disk by the time they saw the trucks turn off the road, turning up the bricked drive that led to the wrought-iron gates of Wyverley College. Home, thought Sabriel for a moment, but that was no longer true. It had been home for the better part of her life, but that was past. It was the home of her childhood, when she was only Sabriel. Now she was also Ab Horsen. Now her home lay in the Old Kingdom, as did her responsibilities. But like her, these travelled.
Electric lights burned brightly in the two antique glass lanterns on either side of the gate, but they dimmed to mere sparks as the wagon and its strange cargo drove through. One of the gates was off its hinges, and Sabriel realized the soldiers must have forced their way through. It was unusual for the gates to be locked before full dark. They must have closed them when they heard the bells, Sabriel realized, and that alerted her to something else. "The bell in the village!" she exclaimed, as the wagon passed several parked trucks and wheeled around to stop near the huge, gate-like doors to the main building of the school. "The bell! It stopped!" Touchstone brought the wagon to a halt and listened, cocking an ear towards the darkening sky. True enough, they could no longer hear the Wyverley village bell. "It is a mile," he said hesitantly. "Perhaps we're too far. The wind..." "No," said Sabriel. She felt the air cool with evening still on her face. There was no wind. "You could always hear it here. Kerrigor has reached the village. We need to get the sarcophagus inside, quickly." She jumped down from the wagon and ran over to Horry's, who was standing on the steps outside the partially open door, talking to an obscured figure within. As Sabriel got closer, edging through groups of waiting soldiers, she recognized the voice. It was Mrs. Umbraid, the headmistress.
"How dare you barge in here?" she was pronouncing very pompously. "I am a very close personal friend of Lieutenant General Farnsley, I'll have you know." "Sabriel!"
The sight of Sabriel in such strange garb and circumstance seemed to momentarily stun Mrs. Umbraid. In that second of fish-mouthed silence, Horry's motioned to his men. Before Mrs. Umbraid could protest, they'd pushed the door wide open, and streams of armed men rushed in, pouring around her startled figure like a flood around an island.
"Mrs. Umbraid!" Sabriel shouted. "I need to talk to Miss Greenwood urgently, and the girls from the senior magic classes. You'd better get the rest of the girls and the staff up to the top floors of the North Tower."
Mrs. Umbraid stood, gulping like a goldfish, till Horry's suddenly loomed over her and snapped,
"Move, woman!"
Almost before his mouth closed, she was gone. Sabriel looked back to check that Touchstone was organizing the shifting of the sarcophagus, then followed her in. The entrance hall was already blocked by a conga line of soldiers, passing boxes in from the trucks outside, stacking them up all along the walls. Khaki-colored boxes marked 0.303 ball, or B2E2WP grenade, piled up beneath pictures of prize-winning hockey teams or gilt-lettered boards of merit and scholastic brilliance. The soldiers had also thrown open the doors to the great hall and were busy in there, closing shutters and piling pews up on their ends against the shuttered windows. Mrs. Umbraid was still in motion at the other end of the entrance hall, bustling along towards a knot of obviously nervous staff. Behind them, peering down from the main stair, was a solid rank of prefects. Behind them, higher up the stair, and just able to see, were several gaggles of non-prefectorial fifth and sixth formers. Sabriel didn't doubt that the rest of the school would be lining the corridors behind them, all agog to hear what the commotion was all about. Just as Mrs. Umbraid reached her staff, all the lights went out. For a moment, there was total, shocked quiet. Then the noise redoubled. Girls screaming, soldiers shouting, crashes and bangs as people ran into things and each other. Sabriel stood where she was and conjured the charter marks for light. They came easily, flowing down to her fingertips like cool water from a shower. She let them hang there for a moment, then cast them at the ceiling, drops of light that grew to the size of dinner plates and cast a steady yellow light all down the hall. Someone else was also casting similar lights down by Mrs. Umbraid, and Sabriel recognized the work of Magistrix Greenwood. She smiled at that recognition, a slight upturning of just one side of her mouth. She knew the lights had gone out, because Kerrigor had passed the electric substation, and that was halfway between the school and the village. As expected, Mrs. Umbraid wasn't telling her teachers anything useful, just going on about rudeness and some general.
Sabriel saw the magistrix behind the tall, bent figure of the senior science mistress, and waved.
"And I was never more shocked to see one of our," Mrs. Umbraid was saying,
when Sabriel stepped up next to her and gently